Hey, Street Fighters, thanks for supporting what we do and listening to the show. This is the audio from the live event we did with the Humor and the Abject podcast. Brian and I talked about our influences, kind of how everything got started, and the genesis of what Street Fight is now. So I hope you want to hear that information because we rarely talk about it. So this is some exclusive audio. I also wanted to let you know that we are taking pre-orders on the Natty Bow shirt. So the sticker that we sent out with the fiction zine with the Brian and I with one eye, we're going to make an official shirt of that. It's going to be burgundy, very classy. We're taking pre-orders at store.streetfightradio.com, where we're going to be taking those until the end of the month. I'm going to be ordering at the beginning of December, so this can be a Christmas gift if you want. If you got that big Street Fight fan in your life, or if you want to send some hints out to your significant other for that gift you really want, go to store.streetfightradio.com, get your pre-order in, so that way you can get this and get... I have nothing. Enjoy the show.
How do you win over your boss? Your boss is the most important person in your career because without them on side, you are not going to.
One more time for Julio Torres. Taylor, can you pause that real quick?
How do you win over your boss?
Okay. Taylor, can you rewind that back and start from the beginning there?
How do you win over your boss? Your boss is the most important person in your career because without them on side, you are not going to get very far, whether it's in terms of pay, promotion, or assignments. Frankly, I have never seen anyone get promoted without their boss's support, unless, of course, that boss was about to be fired. But if we start from the assumption that you're excellent and that you don't have a bad boss, then here are three strategies for winning over your boss. First,
Columbus, Ohio, 6 years before 2017, there lived a strange pair of men, the anarcho-comedian. No one knows how they got people to listen, or how much weed they were smoking. But their legacy remains, distributed across the world wide web as Street Fight Radio.
Street Fight. Are these your drugs?
But Daddy, where did you get it? Daddy,
answer me. Street Fight. Who taught you how to do this stuff?
You, alright? I learned it by watching you.
Parents who use drugs have children who use drugs.
The oath of enlistment. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Street Fight.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, and that I will obey the orders.
Street Fight.
Of the President of the United States and the orders of the officers appointed over me according to regulations and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So help me God.
Where lies the strangling fruit that came from the hand of the sinner, I shall bring forth the seeds of the dead to share with the worms that gather in the darkness and surround the world with the power of their lives, while from the dim-lit halls of other places forms that never were and never could be rise for the impatience of the few who never saw what could have been. In the black water with the sun shining at midnight, those fruits shall come ripe, and in the darkness of that which is golden shall split open to reveal the revelation of the fatal sunkness in the earth. The shadows of the abyss are like the petals of a monstrous flower that shall blossom within the skull and expand the mind beyond what any man can bear. But whether it decays under the earth or above on green fields, or out to sea, or in the very air, all shall come to revelation, and to revel, in the knowledge of the strangling fruit. And the hand of the sinner shall rejoice, for there is no sin in shadow or in light that the seeds of the dead cannot forgive. And there shall be in the planted in the shadows a grace and a mercy from which shall blossom dark flowers, and their teeth shall devour and sustain and herald the passing of an age. That which dies shall still know life in death, for all that decays is not forgotten and reanimated, it shall walk the world in the bliss of not knowing. And then there shall be a fire that knows the naming of you, and in the presence of the strangling fruit, its dark flame shall acquire every part of you that remains. Welcome to hell, you motherfucking screamers. It's humor and the abject. Fucking live. Can you believe it? This is Stefan Lee, the podcast studio manager. Thanks for coming out tonight. We're sponsored this week by the United States military, the DARE program, and your goddamn boss. Are you ready to speedle? Let me hear a yeah, why not? I said, let me hear a yeah, why not? One more time. Let me hear a yeah, why not?
And where are they now? Brett and Brian of Street Fight Radio. And what would they say to us if we were here tonight?
I'm Ira Glass. Welcome to Jackass. It's episode 24 of the Humor and the Abject podcast. Thank you all for coming out this evening and checking this thing out live. It's wonderful to see you, and I'm very happy with the crowd here. Could we hear it once again for Anna Fabreg and Julio Torres, please? And I would also like to give it up for Taylor Moore, who's running the boards and helped put this together. He's also bartending and doing sound. And is Zach here? Zach from Throne Watches, who let us put this together here. He's coming down the stairs now. This is very beautiful. Lovely, lovely, lovely. So how is everyone doing tonight? Doing good? We feeling all right? The weather's beautiful, yes, it's very lovely. So, this evening I'm very happy to have a couple of guests on the first live show. They are visiting from out of town. Many of you probably listen to their podcast. They've been doing it for several years. 6 years now, I think, if that's correct. That's got to be hundreds of episodes. So, Taylor, could you cue up the tune there? Know that song? Ladies and gentlemen, the number one anarcho comedy show on any station across the nation. Please welcome Brett Payne and Brian Quimby from Street Fight Radio. Their mission is to make everything flat, the earth, the society, economics, all of those types of things. So
we don't have to make the earth flat. It's already flat.
Thank you,
that's
Brian.
That's not our job, right? Playing the hits tonight, guys.
No more worries about the shape of the earth. We're done. We figured that one out. Doesn't matter anyways.
Gentlemen, welcome to Human the Abject. How are you both?
Doing great. Thanks for having us.
Coming out of a two-day panic attack.
Yeah. Have you been enjoying New York so far?
Yeah, it's cool. It's very cool. I thought it was going to suck. So being here and it not sucking has been pretty nice.
Wonderful. We wanted to hate it so bad. But when I was a kid, I used to watch City Guys on TNBC. You ever watch that show? No.
No, well, nobody back in Ohio, fucking watched that show.
Back in Ohio, we had this show called City Guys, and they rode subways, and there was bodegas, and there was all of that stuff, and I finally got it, and I can't shit on it at all.
I know. I wanted to just be like, fuck this place. We got everything in Columbus. that this place has, but I mean, it's sort of true, but there's like 100 of every cool thing here. There's one there.
Well, we're glad to be slowly converting you. You know, I just feel like we need to get something out of the way here. I understand that something happened at your hotel recently.
Yeah, we got kicked out of our hotel. So that's been a negative for this.
That was a big departure. they don't want you to vape in the room, apparently. There's no ashes. It doesn't stink up the place. It's like incense or something, right?
You're not allowed to do incense in the rooms either. That's smoke.
Incense?
That's actually smoke, too.
Well, then maybe we got in trouble for the Nag Champa in my bag then.
That's possible. Now I'm starting to think that they saw the kratom and they were like, that must be some powder weed or something. It seemed like they seemed so fucking freaked out about weed that it was like that. These people, like, I'd imagine they've seen it before or have smelled it, because I can't go anywhere in the city without smelling it and urine.
How many New Yorkers like weed out there?
There we go. Yeah. Well, I'm really sorry to hear that happened.
Oh, fuck them. It's not your fault. It was the really stern-looking man.
It is definitely not my fault.
They also, the weird thing about it was this guy, I'm like, we weren't smoking. And he was like, I need you to just leave here peacefully. And he was like, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring security up to make sure that you leave peacefully. And he had like a 65-year-old, 4-foot-tall man standing next to him. And I was like, well, I could take him. I can guarantee that.
Is that your security?
Yeah.
Now, for anybody in the audience or anybody listening to this episode who isn't familiar with Street Fight Radio, could you give a little rundown of what it is that both of you do?
Sure, absolutely. We started because we were doing podcasts at the time. A buddy of ours said, hey, y'all should do a show together. And we kicked the other two guys off his podcast and started Street Fight 6 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it was like they made this huge mistake of like leaving us together. We didn't even know each other, and I would venture to say that we didn't even like each other.
I was skeptical.
Yeah. So, I mean, look at him, right? He is like, oh, I'm going to do a podcast with a 36-year-old cable guy dad. That's going to fucking get me to New York. I'm sure of it.
And then, like, well, I felt like I was being groomed, too, because he was a father at the time. And then he starts coming to me like, I don't trust this fucking government no more, man. And I'm like, I don't think I do either. Like, I think I'm an anarchist.
I actually remember the conversation that we had when I was like, Brett, I'm hearing a lot of this anarchy, and I'm really liking it. And he was like, you know what, man? Feel free to be an anarchist. Nobody can tell you not to. I was like, Fed.
Yeah, I had known him for like 6 months, and I was like, yes, fly the black flag.
Which is funny, because you do this podcast, this kind of fucking like, I mean, basically like an Opie and Anthony sort of ripoff. I was huge fans of those guys and like Ron and Fez and Howard Stern. I just wanted to do something really fucking edgy. You know what I mean? So the other two guys were all in on that. Brett was sort of okay with it. Sort of would be like, sometimes maybe we should stop this edgelord shit. But like...
The empath of the
They group. Both go on vacation at the same time. And Brett and I eat a bunch of fucking weed, and we sit across the table from each other, and we're like, we need to blow up this fucking government, man. Like, the show took this like really dark turn, and I was like, maybe we should go down that path. That seems like something nobody's doing.
We also got in a lot of trouble, because in Ohio, college football is king there. And thank you, small town folk that are in the crowd tonight. And we basically spent the whole show being like, why are 40-year-old men obsessed with what teenagers are doing off the football field? And you're like, it's my right. I listen to sports radio all day about this. I'm an expert. And we're like, fuck you.
And we're screaming about like, you fucking people, they are working for free. It's sick that you watch this shit. And it's like, like somebody's watching it and like, this fucking sucks, man. I hate you. What have you done to my show?
Wait, what happened to the... So, wait, how did you let the other fellas down?
You know, the show had kind of winded down. It was starting to wind down.
That called Street Fight? What was that called?
No, it was a different show. I'm not going to tell you what that show is called.
You have to figure that out for yourself.
About 43 people in Groveport, Ohio listen to it, so you're never going to get your hands on it. But we just kind of like, I was like, I'm going to do an open mic. And I called all three of the other guys, and he went with me. And I was like, what the fuck? Who is this guy? Because, like, we'd been working together, but probably said six words to each other. It would be like, he would show up, we'd go down, record the show, and then I would angrily leave, like, 2 hours later and just go home. There wasn't, like, a lot of conversations. But then, you know, I mean, doing stand-up the first time is fucking stressful. And, like, sure. The fact that the other guys didn't go with me was like, you know, this guy went with me. And then he did it the very next week. And it was just kind of like, that's when we started doing it every day. And this thing built from that.
So it's like 2011?
Yeah, it was 2011. Yeah. We were. You wouldn't believe how unpopular anarcho-comedy was in 2011.
What is that? Are there other folks that use that sort of descriptor to describe what they do?
I don't think so. I mean, I try to be first on that one, I hope. That's the best part about being first is you're number one.
It's like, so in Columbus, an open mic night is a lot of guys doing a rough approximation of what a New York or LA comic does. So it's like, oh, I'm out here jerking off and riding on the subway and farting and shit. I would go on stage and be like, I like to steal my daughter's cough syrup. And like, here's a funny joke about stealing copper wire. Or like,
I tried to convince all the kids to revolt against the school because there were tax hikes. Like, I had 5 minutes. It's 1:30 in the morning. And I'm telling this guy, like, tonight we're taking over Ohio State University if you're with me. And then some guy went up after me and was like, you ever seen those commercials where a guy is crazy and he has a lot of deals?
Are both of you from Columbus originally?
Or? Yeah. I'm from Groveport, but it is like 10 miles from Columbus. Okay. It's like, I live near him. We're both pretty close to downtown, but it's really weird, but like, you could live 5 miles from downtown in Columbus and never go downtown for your whole life. And if you do, they're absolutely convinced you're going to get stabbed. So I never went there. I didn't go there. The only time we really went there when I was growing up was to buy bongs and shit. Like, get out bongs and corn import albums.
They had those UFO pants. You remember UFOs? Anybody that's over 25?
Wait, are those like Zubaz?
No, they were like these. No, they. Well, everybody, they were just as big. Like, yeah. They were gigantic, like parachute material pants. Okay. With, like, the cargo pockets and like strings hanging off of them. They were raver pants.
That's
cool. I mean, what I liked about them was, I was a cable guy for a while, and a lot of pockets really help. But they wouldn't let me wear UFOs on the job. It was bullshit. I hated it. Oh, you got to wear jeans. All right, Jesus. I wear jeans and boots to do comedy. It's like, yeah! I'm following the dress code 5 years after I've left the company that I ruthlessly fought against the entire time I was there. No, I would take tennis shoes, like regular shoes, in my van and put them in there. And as soon as I got a mile down the road, I'd take my boots off and put my regular shoes on.
Oh, man. I don't know why that just made me think of this, but did you ever see that Canadian TV show that was sort of like a Canadian cowboy, and they would let people loose in the woods, and he would hunt them down? Manhunter.
No, I haven't. It sounds excellent, though.
I feel like y'all would like that, but that just made me think of it because a trick that everybody would try to use, because Manhunter was a master tracker, is they would cut the soles off of another pair of shoes and glue them on backwards. So when they were running, it would look like they were running the other way.
Nice.
But he could tell by the footfall, and Manhunter would ride up on his horse. He never got off, and he would look down and just say, They're not running backwards.
I fucking remember Manhunter. He was like a cowboy.
Yes, you saw
it. They would just be. It was like a fucking game show.
And they would
fire
a flare, and he'd have like 48 hours to find him.
Oh fuck! I loved Manhunter.
Yeah, it's really good.
The reason I didn't know that is because you said Canadian.
He was a Canadian cowboy. That was my first. He said his O's differently. That's how I remember.
My dad lived in Canada for the first like 9 years of his life, and he's convinced he's Canadian. So I avoid everything.
Technically, that would make him Canadian, though.
He's not fucking Canadian. He's lived in Columbus, Ohio for the other fucking 40 years of his life. It balances out.
Can you get us on Manhunter?
I think it... I don't know if it's on TV anymore, but that would be...
Will you hunt us?
Yeah, I would love to. I would love to see that in the city here, where we have to...
You gotta do that fucking show where they get you naked and drop you on an island now. That Naked and Afraid. Have you guys seen that? I love that fucking show because, like, being naked is my worst nightmare, even, like, just in my bathroom alone.
Hold on. Y'all are a few years apart, though, right? So, and you didn't meet till you were doing the podcast.
No, we didn't. I am 38, and he's younger than me. See, I don't know his age.
I'm 33, but all my toys were hand-me-downs. It was all like Thundercats, Silverhawks, Transformers. It was like everything that he played with just because I didn't get brand new toys when I was a kid. So we clicked pretty well.
Oh, yeah. You got the second gen of the... Yeah.
Really, we were both... Like, the truth is, we were both like very pop culture obsessed growing up. We were both... Like, we both know... A bunch of really fucking stupid shit. Like what was going on MTV in 1993. It's like we both know all that shit, which is weird because we're not at all anymore. But like all of our like memories are basically the same. It's fucking weird. I don't know. Like,
I feel like toys are a good kind of way to link people together, though. In kindergarten, we had a whole section of action figures and things like that, and I started pocketing them. I was about 5. I'd do like one a week, and I had this pillowcase behind the couch in our living room, and I would, when my parents were looking, I would pull it back, and I would drop like a He-Man cat or something back there and slide it shut. And I was kind of like edging with the toys because I couldn't play with them. Until my folks would leave, and then my babysitter Heidi would come over, and as soon as the transition happened, I would run and yank them out and just, you know, start playing with them and hide the pillowcase. But one time she saw me putting them back and narked me out.
And I had babysitters, man. I should hear about Brett's from old babysitters.
Yeah,
I had a similar thing. When I was a kid, my babysitter taught me how to steal at an early age. So, like, she would set up necklaces and stuff around the house, like on doorknobs or, like, open medicine cabinets, and we would, like, practice sliding it up up our shirt and then, like, hooking it on our thumb or something and just, like, walking out the door. So we moved when I was, like, 11 or 12, and I threw, like, a soccer ball-sized keychain ball. Like, it was just all these keychains. We would go to the mall, and I would steal keychains. And then I'm like, this collection is getting too fucking big. And then my mom's like, we're moving. I was like, the furniture in here? Because there's all kinds of stuff hidden. So I have to, like, run in the middle of the night and throw away everything I had stolen, including this gigantic soccer ball that wouldn't even go down. I had to, like, kick it down the manhole.
Jesus.
The sewer.
I had a party one time when I was, like, 17. When I was, like, 17, my parents would go camping every weekend, and we would have these fucking massive parties. They were stupidly huge for a bunch of teenagers. It's kind of like getting kicked out of a hotel for smoking weed in a way. You would just go way too big, and you would have a fucking trash can, like one of those big Rubbermaid trash cans full of bottles and cans and shit. Mm-hmm. And we would walk down the street and stuff that thing down the sewer.
Wait,
or leave it in the playground of a school.
What's the can deposit in Ohio?
None. That's Michigan.
Oh,
Michigan,
yeah. We had 10 cents. You didn't throw that shit away.
Oh, 10 cents. I had a nickel. Me and my dad, we used to run through with the magnets. That's how I got that NES game, Skate or Die, was off of cans.
From returning them?
Yeah, yeah.
That's good. Great game. Yeah. Yeah, that's very good. Speaking of shoplifting, last Christmas around that time, we were visiting Claire's family in Tucson, and her dad took her little brother, he's her half-brother, he's 6, to this place and he shoplifted a pack of gum. And he got caught. He took it back and made him return the pack of gum. And during the return, he swiped another one.
And that's a good move.
And he brought it home and he got caught again. And I remember having this really conflicted conversation with him, and I was just sort of like, my man, like, you stole from sort of like a bougie gentrifying coffee shop thing, which is in and of itself is not a problem, but you've created a situation for your dad
where
you know, that's where the problem is. But it,
but he can own, he's going to own the world if he has that kind of confidence. I mean, he can go anywhere with
But I realize that I don't know if I'm equipped to be a parent because of the inherent contradictions in things and how tough that must be. And both of you are parents, right?
Yeah, it, you know, my kid watches me steal. She's so fucking... She's so annoyed. She's so annoyed at my new technique. But you know that she has to, like, be like, that's fucking awesome that my dad does it. What I do is I go to the self-scan checkout, and I take a small expensive thing and just throw it in the bag. And it'll be like, please remove the last item from the scanner and wait. And I'll just stand and be like, what the fuck, man? This technology's fucking stupid. It's almost quicker to go through the regular line. And then they'll fucking clear it because they don't want some angry white dad fucking screaming in their face.
Yeah, I did a podcast recently with these guys. They were all younger and they're wearing like filthy hoodies they've been in for a month. And they're like, why are you dressed up all nice? And I was like, look, guys, look, it's way easier to get away with theft when you look like this. If you wear like a filthy hoodie, you're not going to get anything. I can walk out of any store I want with my shirt tucked in, and I can get away with anything. So be a normie. Consider going to the thrift store, get like some Gap button-up shirts and some khakis and get away with fucking murder.
When you were growing up, were there specific comedians that either of you were into, or does the sense of humor kind of come from... I feel like you have a similar disposition to a lot of the people that I knew in the Midwest, which is just you kind of develop this...
I didn't love stand-up comedy. Actually, the first time I ever made somebody laugh, I went to my elementary school and did a fucking Louis Anderson bit, and everybody was losing their fucking minds, and I was like, I could do this. But no, I didn't really love it. I watched a lot of wrestling and stuff, and like, so a lot of my heroes were pro wrestlers, or like, man, Bobby the Brain Heenan, I think, is like one of the funniest guys, rest in peace, that ever lived. Or when I turned 17, I read Private Parts.
Oh. And I remember. I saw the movie. I didn't read it, but
I read it in in-school suspension for my like 47th day in a row.
Did you get in trouble for having that type of literature in a school setting?
When you're like I was in high school, they would just like it if you'd sit quietly.
They saw you had a book. So, yeah.
They do not care what you do. So I read that book and then later got into like Opie and Anthony, and I liked those guys.
I thought you were going to say opiates.
Yeah, well, yeah, that too. I mean, I was. Until Anthony turned into a Nazi. I need to like let you guys know I didn't like them when they got... I mean, when they were covertly racist, it was one thing. But it was when they got overtly racist, I was out, you know? But Ron Bennington is kind of my... Ron Bennington and Patrice O'Neill, those are my two guys. I think they're the two funniest guys in the world.
Yeah.
So I get 20/20 hindsight on this a little bit. And, like, a lot of what we do was simply based around the idea. Like he said, we went to stand-up shows, open mics, and all of that. And it seemed like people were trying to do... general big city type thing that would apply to a lot of audiences, and so we wanted to do something different and like also troll at the same time. So if you say you're proud of being from Ohio, that pisses people off immediately. If you say you like square pizza, that pisses people off immediately. So a lot of it was about finding our own voice, but I think the most inspiration for me was when I used to stay with my grandma. We could stay up all night, and we watched Saturday Night Live, and like just watching that like blew me away. Adam Sandler and Chris Farley and Phil Hartman and all of that, and then later I used to watch In Living Color. So for me, it was always character-based stuff. I was like so afraid. It's really sucked. I took so long to get into this, and I was so into like drama and performance and all of these things, but it just, I was too afraid to ever go for it, and there was no environment. But I was really focused on these people that would put themselves out there and make these characters. And that's where a lot of the humor of the show, I think, comes from, is instead of doing like an impression of somebody famous, we do an impression of a guy in a break room. And sure, like everybody kind of knows who we're talking about. Everybody has a Ben or whatever, a Mark, whoever is this really stale guy in the room. So we get to... Stale. Sorry all the Bens and Marks. I owe you a drink or a vape hit. But yeah, so I mean, that was big for me. I did pay attention to a lot of stand-up. I even remember when I was like 20, to one of my friends, he was like, you should go on that MTV show Made and do like stand-up comedy. I'm like, that's fucking crazy. No way. I'm throwing boxes for $9 an hour. I love this.
No, that's the other thing with me is like, I have a hard time. I don't like to repeat stuff. And I think sometimes like jokes can come off sounding corny, and I don't really know how to not do that, so I just do this. Mm-hmm. Like that's what happened. And he's right too. I mean, like any Midwestern or mid-sized city, you go and you watch comedy, they're not talking like people from they're talking about people like people from here, and mm-hmm. it doesn't track with anybody that lives there. Like fucking. This is the first time I've ever been to New York. Like, I don't know anything about the fucking subway. So, like, I just wanted to talk about what it's like to be a guy that, like, is just trying, like, kind of a scumbag that's trying to get by in life, you know?
Or, yeah, or like, what if you're plopped in the middle of an exurb with a whole bunch of time on your hand? That was my lived experience. I don't know what it was like to be in the center of culture or anything like that, you know?
Sure, yeah, yeah. What was it that happened that, and I assume that it probably happened separately from the two of you and then you sort of crossed paths, but you've talked a little bit about on the show, like when you got radicalized or when your politics changed, and I'm curious what it was that sort of shifted that for both of you.
It happened at exactly the same time. That's why we're like brothers. That's why I love this guy, because like, you know, Obama got elected. I immediately assumed we were going to have like some kind of a black communism sort of thing, and I was very excited about it.
We were both rooting for that, and it wasn't the same time, because 3 months in, he was like, fuck this Obama guy, he's a goddamn liar. And I'm like, hold up a second, who knows? It's 3 months. He's like, I'm done with this. I thought this was going to be the promised land.
And then 3 months later, Brett was like, fuck this Obama guy. You know, I can't fucking deal with this shit anymore. And then it was like it's real corny. It's like the drone strike thing hit us both super hard, and we just became those guys that only fucking talk about drone strikes. Nothing else. And it's like, who the fuck are you going to radicalize? Like, only talking about just this thing that happens all the way across the world. Like, they don't fucking care. So, you know, as I got, I guess, smarter, I guess, I went to college in the middle of this thing, you know?
Well, instead of college, I studied with Alex Jones for quite some time. So I knew that both the Democrats and Republicans were reptilians.
Yeah,
so I was ready for that. Yes. I just needed a reason. I was like, Obama's reptilian. I'm out of the Democrats. Done.
That's every time some politician that everybody wants gets elected, I'm always just like, everybody's going to like leave America now, man, because like they're not going to do anything. Never happens. People are always like, I'm still a Democrat. I think we can get them to turn, you know? And I'm like, I don't think so. I don't think anybody's turning.
Yeah, so it was a lot of back and forth with us. I think just for me, I was out and against George W. Bush, which was easy to do when he was the president.
I was for George W. Bush when he was the president.
So, but I had this list of things that I didn't stand for. Like, I was already against imperialism. I was against the terrorism. I was against all of the Patriot Act and all of those things. So I thought, like, when the Democrats came around and they started doing the same old stuff, that we were all going to give them the same shit that we gave to George W. Bush. And other people were like, I'm fine with this. And I was just so disillusioned by that I was just like, this is not for me. And I'm not going to lie to myself. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of went through a thing like, so I, like every fucking idiot Midwestern dad, was like, I'm having a kid. I need to pay attention to politics now. So I had my kid, and I was kind of like a trending toward Republican a little bit, because I was a cable guy for 7 years, and for four of those years, you're driving around in a car. There's, if you want to listen to people talking on the radio, you there all that's there is conservatives, and they're telling you, like, you know, everybody, these liberals are fucking you over, man. And it just, it feels like somebody's actually talking to you, where it was like there was nobody else doing that. Like, sure. There, and then Air America came out, and coincidentally, I turned into a Democrat. So it's pretty much whoever was talking to me, I was like, yeah, you got a lot of, this motherfucker makes a lot of good points.
Well, I think some of the stuff that, and I, you know, I get pretty nerded out on different types of political podcasts, Intercepted, or listening to talk radio and things like that, primarily from a more liberal or left side. But one of the things that I think is really interesting about Street Fight is that some of the stuff that y'all tackle, whereas let's say I listen to an episode of Intercepted and it's just like, listen to how, you know, literally horrible everything is in these superstructures that I have, at literally nothing that I do is going to change any of it. And something about the topics that you seem to tackle, or the way that you incorporate different voices onto the show, seems far more engaging, even if some of the things are a little bit smaller. And just as an example, I was listening to a very recent episode, and I lived in Portland, Oregon for several years, and you were talking to the people that were attempting to unionize Burgerville, which is, I don't know if anybody in the audience knows Burgerville, but in the Pacific Northwest, it's this kind of like Northwest In-N-Out Burger that posits itself as very local, really sort of sustainable and all these things. And you do feel like you're voting with your dollar when you go there, and you assume that the employees are being treated a certain way. I had literally, I mean, I'm obviously naive. I should have assumed, you know, any business is going to do that. But I just sort of thought, like, no, it's got to be better than these other places. But you did a whole episode with these two people, and that completely, like, kind of changed my perspective on the whole thing. And I realized that I was just being this kind of lib consumer that was like, well, you know, they say sustainable, so I'm gonna find my stuff here.
It's always funny because you like all the, you never hear them say, like, they basically treat the cows better than they treat the employees, you know? That's what it always comes down to, because it's like, well, yeah, we're paying a minimum wage. I mean, Burgerville was a huge thing. Like, talking to those people about Burgerville was a big thing for me, because I kind of wondered, I had wondered what it was like to try to unsuccessfully organize a workplace. You know what I mean? And like what it's like personally to sit at a table across from another employee and say, we're going to try to make a fucking union, and how they would act. And getting that input on that really was, that was important. That was actually one of the more important episodes to me. I was really blown away by, like, even the courage to try to do something like that. And the fucking ruthless way that they were treated by that company.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and for us, I think it hit a point where we wanted to put some sort of talk radio. I mean, I got into the podcasting thing very early, like 2007, 2008, and I was blown away with the people that, the voices that I was hearing. It felt like early cable TV, where like anybody could have a show, anything could happen. And so we got into the game thinking that we were doing this, wanting to be political and all of those things. But after a few years in, we had the listenership. People knew what we did, and it was like, we just need to be funny first, because whenever we try to crack a joke, all of a sudden it becomes about, like, shouldn't everybody get paid a living wage? I'm not doing it on purpose, but that's just, like, where my mind is at, you know? And, like, that doesn't work with my in-laws. You know, they don't want to hear about peace on earth.
when you're like, now the world, what also helped us a lot, really, I think this is something that helped me, because I kind of, if people don't realize that I steer the show, I come up with the stories and I do that, and then he comments basically on the stories, and oh, thank you. So.
You're the Pete Wentz of Fallout Boy. You're sort of the architect who's kind of behind in the shadows.
Well, he's so fucking good at the radio stuff, isn't he? Like, it's just fucking, when that show pops on, Pete, it's like, Wentz? hey, there's fucking all kinds of energy. I got all that websites right. When I used to do it, I'm like, hey, you're listening to, you've heard the third show. Sure. Hey, you're listening to Street Fight. I don't have to do anything on this show because you're already on Patreon. Here's my guest. And like, so like I put those things together and, you know, we're friends with the guys from Chapo. We're friends with the guys from District Sentinel Radio. We're friends with the people from, with Roque and Q-Mars from Delete Your Account. And like, if you look at those shows, you know, Chapo talks about pundits and they fucking destroy them. They destroy the punditries. They destroy the politicians. The Sams do an excellent job of covering the news and telling you what's going on procedurally in the government, you know? And I think the Delete Your Account, they do a really good job of talking about organizing and collective action. And so I felt like what we had that none of them had was that, like, we're in the fucking middle of the shit. And we can talk about what it's like to work in the United States. Because I think that, like, so much labor reporting doesn't really focus on what it's actually like to be at work. And, like, you'd be so surprised at, like, the DMs I get from people who are like, shit, you just said exactly what my work situation is. And I'm like, yeah, it's fucking everybody's like that.
Well, it seems like the... I mean, it's become sort of a hilarious trope in the call-in shows where somebody will call in from a particular type of business and begin to express, like, a thing about their boss, and you'll guess what the small business owner is doing to them before they finish the sentence. And it's the same across the board. And I think that that's something that, you know, I think I always knew from working at places, but until I heard it expressed multiple times to really... Because when you work in one of these places, you feel like you're part of a family or like a team, and everybody's kind of in it together, and there's no HR person, but you're being fucked.
Well,
oh, yeah.
It's only a family because you put up with way too much dysfunction. That's the only thing that qualifies as a family, is that someone will say, fuck you, I hope you die, clock in at 8 tomorrow. I mean... And for me, like, I had no other prospects. Like, I followed my wife to Dallas, Texas, and I had a decent job where we were at. I was providing for both of us at the time. But when I rolled into a new city with no degree, and I'm just going through Craigslist, it's like, I don't want to do anything. I don't want to do any of these. These all are all scams. These all look like scams. And one of the jobs I ended up having in Dallas, the whole time they were like, you know, we've hired a few eBay guys in here, and they just disappear in the middle of the night in 6 months. And that was exactly my fucking plan. I needed it for 6 months, and then I disappeared on them, just like the last Jeff did.
A lot like most, like, see, what I went through was what most fucking 24-year-olds are going through. Like, I finished college, and I wasn't getting that financial aid check anymore, and I needed to bring money into the house, so I ended up working at first a deli that I threw salad dressing at the boss and told him to go fuck himself.
What dressing? What?
All of it. So what happened was...
The ramekin tray.
I had a tray of ramekins with the tops on them. There were probably about 60 of them in there. And I went to set it down, and he was like, what are you, fucking stupid? And I was like, what? And he was like, there's a piece of meat right there. And I'm telling you, it was the smallest little crumb of fucking meat. And he said, there's a piece of meat right there. I was like, guess what, buddy? Go do it yourself. And I pushed it across the table, and it busted all over the floor and went all over this guy's feet. And I said, fuck you, you're an asshole, and nobody here likes you. So I went from that to a camera store. Where they were like, hey, we're fucking pretty hip here, man. You can wear whatever clothes you want. We're going to treat you pretty nice. And I was like, okay. They're like, says here you're asking for $9 an hour. Can you do it for $8.45? And I was like, shit, this doesn't seem like a family. And then as I worked there, I tried to take days off, and they denied every single fucking one. For $8.45 an hour, they denied every day off. So... You know, then we did the thing in Philadelphia, so I quit and was like, fuck you, I'm leaving, you know?
No, one of my favorite parts about that job, though, is when he came to me, he was like, I went to the Bernie Sanders rally today, my fucking boss was there. Like,
He's holding a sign for like $15 an hour and paying me $8.45.
What?
Take some initiative, buddy.
That's the genesis of small business tyrants. Was I did run into this guy at a fucking Bernie Sanders rally that is not giving me insurance, is not like paying me even close to what a minimum wage would be. And he's like, fuck, I wish everybody was doing better. And it's like, you have some power in that. You could really do something here. what do they say to themselves? Because, you know, when we go into these places, we say, like, I got to have the fucking job, you know. Old Terry's nice, I guess. He's nice enough. He doesn't yell at me anymore. Sure. Like, what do they say? Like, fight for 15. Really, though. Let's fucking hold back on that a little bit.
I used to work for, in my freshman year of college, between the first year and the second year, I went home to Traverse City, Michigan, and at night I delivered pizzas for Domino's, and during the day I worked for the city streets department, so I got to drive one of those little yellow, like, S10 pickups with a thing on the top, and, you know, I kind of took it seriously. I had to be there really early, and my job was to clean up different parking lots around town, mow the lawns and the medians and things like that.
Fucking dream job for me when I was a kid.
Well, it was pretty chill because, like, a couple weeks in, I met these older guys. They're probably in their 50s. They've been doing it for years. And I was sent out in a truck with one of them, and they did some sanitation thing or something. And, you know, we left the shop, drove around for about 15 or 20 minutes, and we went into the subdivision that my godmother actually lived in. And I was like, oh, I know Quail Ridge. Like, yeah, I've been up here before. And he kept driving, then we went around, and I was like, oh, there's a housing development back here. Nobody lives here. I don't know what the streets department is doing. Then he just drove to the bottom of a cul-de-sac really far away from this construction. He just sat there, turned the car off, and laid back and went to sleep. And I was just sitting in the passenger seat, and I was like, God, what the fuck is this guy doing, you know? And then I was like, well, okay, I guess I'll take a nap too. And so I took a nap just sitting there, and, you know, he left the radio on, like, kind of quiet, just so it wasn't weird. And then
to lull you to sleep.
Yeah, and then I woke up, and he was like, I'm just letting you know how we do things around here. He's like,
oh, that is so.
He was like,
I used to do that at the cable company when they would send somebody to ride with me. I'd be like, you want me to just drop you off at home and come pick you up later? Like, I'd take them to my house and, like, play video games with them and shit.
I got really good. I found all kinds of places to sleep around the city. And I would just turn on your squawk box real loud because it would, if you heard, I started to have a truck 137. I wouldn't wake up for any other number. But if I heard that, it would jerk me awake. And I would jump in and drive the thing around and go back and, like, say that I was doing something. But that was the best job I ever had because I also had, it was my first experience with any authority, and I had the whole back of the truck was orange cones because I had to block off things to mow and stuff, and I would just arbitrarily shut down major intersections in the city. Like, during the summer in Traverse City, they have this thing called the Cherry Festival. It's like 1 million people come to Traverse City, Michigan. It's like 100 times the population, and I would just go and block, like, the major intersection by the bay. And then, like, the guys thought it was hilarious because I was like, it seems like when there's 15 of you standing around a manhole smoking cigarettes and one of you is down there, that he's the only one doing anything. And they were like, mm-hmm. Like, what the fuck do you want? We're being paid. They're like adults. They're being paid like $8 an hour. Like, they don't give a shit. And I learned to respect. That was my first, like, oh, yeah, working class. Like, yeah.
I mean, being able to, like, that is part of, like, any career. Like, because growing up for me, it was like, you got to get a fucking job at the electric company, the cable company, or for the fucking city, which I succeeded in. I got a job at the cable company. And when I got there, I was like, this fucking sucks, man. They, like, paid me $9.50 an hour to start out, and, like, but they let me drive around in a van all day, so I loved it. I was like, fuck it, you know?
Well, you had it, but I want you to tell the story, though, about how you got your future boss, like how he made his moves by talking about
shit.
Downtown.
Yeah. What happened was, like, so this fucking guy gets a job with us, and he's being trained, and the guy that's training him takes him to his house, and he fucking plays video games with him. This fucking trainee goes in and he's like, hey, it's cool that we get to play video games all day. And they were like, what the hell happened? Now he was a manager when I left. Like, he leapfrogged me so fast in the company. Like, I saw him move up, and that's when I was like, management is all bad. Like, it's us versus them.
wait, Brett, so what kind of jobs were you doing? I always hear you talking on the show about being a secret shopper and weird things like that. Like, what?
It's a good way to make money. Well, I started out, I did, like, collections over the phone. But, like, I...
Were you really lenient?
Huh? Yes, I was. Like, someone would tell me a sad story, and I'd be like, that is so fucked up. Your mom did that to you with your social? Let me get you some credits. You give me $5 a month this whole year, I'm going to credit you back all your late fees. And they did not like that. I figured out how to sit on the phones for a while, and then I ended up driving a forklift because my dad drove one when I was a kid, and then I realized why we eat buttered noodles for dinner all the time. But that's what I really just wanted to drive power equipment. If I would have never be on this stage if they would have just gave me $18 an hour to drive that forklift.
I say that too. I would never have done this if somebody would have paid me $18 an hour to throw boxes in the back of a truck. Like, that's all I fucking wanted. When I was a kid, I was like, just pay me $18 an hour and tell me to pick this thing up and take it over there. And that'll really fucking be just the dream for me. And then when I found out, like, shit, it doesn't exist, I was like, I guess I gotta be a comedian now.
I'm sure they have an algorithm, though, that lands right in the middle about how much people will get paid before they get radicalized and how long they can kind of ride that out. And so I'm sure they've done the numbers and they lost two of you, but they've kept...
Yeah, as long as they don't pay minimum, they're fine. Like, they're like, minimum $7.25, that's unacceptable. We'll give you $7.50. Like, okay, fine. This is a stable position now.
They told me at the cable company, we have a no layoff policy. And then people were like, hey, they will fire you, though, if they don't like you. And it's like, well, shit, man, there's no security in this either. There was just, it seemed like everywhere I went, after high school, there was no fucking security. And that is really, like, even if you're making $8 or $9 an hour or something, the job feels so precarious that's, I think, what fucks with people. I think people adapt to low wages and people adapt to not having insurance. But I think that always thinking that your job could go away tomorrow scares the shit out of everybody. And that's why we all have anxiety around our jobs.
Well, and I'll tell you, the way that I got by when I worked at the warehouse... Oh, go ahead. Give it to him. So, when I was doing the forklift, I was working for Abercrombie & Fitch. And so
woo!
I would buy gift cards and sell them on eBay. Like, I would buy a gift card for a $500 gift card for $300 and sell it for, like, $450. So that was, like, making all the ends meet for me. Until they found it and then fired me for it. So then I went to my other job, which was working for this insurance. It was like a startup company. And basically what I did there was start Street Fight Radio. Well, I spent all of my time at work not doing my job.
But wage theft.
Yeah, graphic design. All of our early stuff was done on the job.
Who does double time at work? Yeah? All right, good.
Got to have that hustle.
That's what I like to hear.
But then, so for me, I was actually in a good place then. That's why my wife fell in love with me. She didn't know what to expect. After we moved, though, I had nothing else. I worked for a magnet. This guy it was a magnet.
How do they work?
I fucking love that guy, too. The guy he worked for, I just wanted to hug him every day because he was so mean to Brett.
What is it? Wait, but really, what is a magnet?
So,
No, I'm serious. I don't know what that is.
It's this piece of metal that trades N's and S's back and forth between each other, and it causes them to stick.
What do you mean you worked for a magnet?
So, I'm sorry. This guy was a magnet importer. Rare earth magnets.
I thought it was like a magnet school.
No.
That's a thing, right?
No. It was basically this guy. He had a business. He was up at 4 a.m. talking to distributors, and he handed his boss over to this guy named John. And John was about 72 years old, and he wore a black sweatsuit every single day. Like sweatpants with a sweatshirt, Velcro shoes, and a cowboy hat. That was his boss cowboy hat. Like Anna said.
Like Anna said, yeah, the cowboy hat.
It made him jolly or whatever. But he really, he would vape. He was early on the vape, too. He had a USB one with like a whip. He looked like the caterpillar from Alice in Wonderland, but he would take a break from the vape to go outside and smoke Pall Malls. But when he wasn't doing all of that, I mean, that nicotine gave him like eagle eye vision, because I was in the office with him, and he would just watch my screen. I was like, "Don't you, are you doing work over there, or are you just watching me on Twitter right now?" I don't get it.
He fucking would, like, the funniest thing is, like, Brett one time told me when we were about to do the show, he's talking on the phone for, like, 2 hours before we do the show, and Brett was like, "This motherfucker got behind me and started massaging my shoulders, and I think he was threatening me."
It was a hard squeeze.
Yeah.
He was just like, "We need to stay on task here." I was like, "Okay, I get it. I won't complain."
I'd have whooped his ass, though. That's what I would have done to him.
That place was awful, though, because instead of giving you a raise, they would just buy you a Pizza Hut pizza on Friday.
That's like, book it.
What's that?
It's like, book it.
Yeah, pretty much. You got gold stars this week. You get a pizza.
So these days, is a street fight pretty much the full-time gig of what y'all are doing?
Yeah. I mean, it couldn't be if I didn't have, like, an insanely great wife that makes enough money, and same with him. Like, we don't quite make... Because we don't get all that Patreon money. So I wish we got all that. What?
You're shipping stuff out. You're making zines. You're bagging Kratom.
Yeah. So we don't get all that. But like, it's my full-time job. This is what I'm doing now. I'm not doing anything else.
Folks out there, someday you can do spreadsheets for yourself.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem here. Brett has to do all of the business stuff. And I do all of the other stuff. So it's like really like, it probably feels a hell of a lot more like a job to him than it does to me.
Sort of like you're like a podcast administrator.
Customer service. I'm still CSR.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't have C-level suites in Street Fight, so yeah, I'm just basically banging out on the phones trying to get high on my break.
That's cool. Well, I mean, congratulations on sticking it out this long and doing all the things, and I think that, you know, a lot of the people who are here are obviously fans of Street Fight, and anybody who's listening to this episode who hasn't checked it out, I really encourage them to listen. It's, as I said earlier, a show that certainly touches on a lot of the politics that are things that people are talking about right now, but again... You seem to focus on people and stories and in areas where it feels a little bit like you can get involved, or maybe it's something about... I mean, I started getting... You know, when I started listening to Street Fight, I got thrilled about stealing from my boss. I mean, I'd always been... I'd always stolen from every job. Every job I'd ever had, I'd stolen from. But I grew up Irish Catholic. I felt horrible about it. And then
you're in a guilt-based, like, motivation.
Yeah,
system.
Yeah. But then, you know, now I'm just like, well, why the fuck? What poster did y'all post the other day that was like, if you're not stealing from your boss, you're stealing from your family that you saw somewhere? Like,
that thing fucking ruled. Yeah. I couldn't believe that.
It's making the round. We saw it in Milwaukee and Columbus. Like, it's going around.
Nice. Well, guys, thank you so much for stopping by tonight and doing the live episode. Thank you to everybody in the audience. Thank you again to Taylor for running sound, to Zach for hosting, and one more time for Anna Fabrega and Julio Torres, please. Thanks, Screedlers. We'll see you next week.
Either you are or you're falling apart, and it opened a can of worms. And that gun's in my hand, and I know it looks bad, but believe me, I'm innocent. And I'm fearful of flying, and flying is fearful of me. And I covered my eyes when she told me the news, turning me on with my lightsaber cocksucking blue. Stain on account of a crutch, and I'm aching from fucking too much. And I know what I do, and it all points to you. Did you sell me to Wanderlust? And I'm fearful of flying, and flying is fearful of me. And I covered my eyes when she told me the news, turning me on with my lightsaber cocksucking.